This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I'm Sandra Smith.
I'm Trey Gowdy.
I'm Shannon Bream, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, December 27th, 2022. I'm Lisa Brady. All that screen time isn't just flooding young minds, it's also shaping them.
Putting these modern-day weapons of mass destruction, these smartphones, in the hands of kids that are 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, is probably the dumbest thing that we can do as a society.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. This past year was sadly another year of mass shootings, and it was also a year that the FBI said they were surging personnel to domestic terrorism investigations, due in part to stop attacks motivated by hate, like the one that targeted black supermarket shoppers in Buffalo, New York. One man shared with us his prior life of anger and racism and how he left it behind.
When I walked in that door, I walked into that treatment center one person and came out another. And that's where I think another seed was planted for me to leave the white supremacist movement.
I'm Liz Peek. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
There's been an outsized focus lately on the inner workings of Twitter, changes made after Elon Musk bought the platform, and revelations about controversial decisions made before he was in charge.
If Twitter is doing one team's bidding before an election, shutting down dissenting voices on a pivotal election, that is the very definition of election interference.
The months-long drama stealing some of the spotlight from broader concerns about social media in general, including the impact on a generation of younger users, questions and challenges that continue to grow for parents.
All of this really started in 2012.
Tom Kersting is a family therapist and author of Disconnected. He's got a new book, Raising Healthy Teenagers, coming out in February.
The escalation of poor mental health, the increase in the suicide rate, all started in 2012. And guess what came out in 2012? Smartphones. Our kids are spending 8 or 9 hours a day, okay, on another planet, the cyber world. Much of that time is immersed and hypnotized in social media, which is shaping their mind, their emotions, and is the cause of the mental health epidemic.
And when you say shaping their mind, I just want to seize on that for a moment, because it's not until you're pretty well into your 20s that the brain is fully developed, correct? I always feel like it's important to remind people about that.
Yeah. So here's the thing, you know, people ask me all the time, they'll say, you know, how do I teach, you know, my kid how to be responsible, like with their phones and social media? And I explain to them that they can't be responsible. We have to do that for them. And to your point, there's an area in the brain, it's called the prefrontal cortex. And that's the part of the brain that's responsible for decision-making, risky behavior, and things of that nature. And that part of the brain, it doesn't fully develop until somewhere between 23 and 25 years old. So putting these modern-day weapons of mass destruction, these smartphones, in the hands of kids that are 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, is probably the dumbest thing that we can do as a society.
And it's not just self-esteem you're talking about in terms of the impact, right? Development in general, when you're looking at a screen instead of interacting in person or involved in other activities. I mean, how big of a problem is that?
Yeah, so in my next book coming out, Raising Healthy Teenagers, I actually tap into that about the social skills deficit among kids today. And social skills, you know, human beings, we're social emotional beings, right? So we are meant to be out there, you know, interacting. For example, play is down 70-something percent in recent years, outdoor play. And the kids that are immersed in outdoor play with other kids have substantially better mental health outcomes. So we, as humans, we must be connecting face-to-face with other people, you know, verbally and non-verbally. Sitting in front of a screen is what I call dehumanizing.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you're pinning the vast majority of the increase in mental health issues and suicides on, you know, social media related issues. just to play devil's advocate, I mean, people might say, well, no, there's other factors. You can't blame it all on social media or devices, but you are a therapist. So I assume that you have seen changes in who is coming to you and for what reasons, you know, as awareness has improved, you know, as well. There's been more of a national conversation about mental health. So this is what you've personally witnessed.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm one of the leading experts in this space. You know, the first time I lectured on this was in 2009. And yeah, at my private practice, you know, starting in right around 2012, in fact, I was also working at a public high school. The amount of kids that were referred to me for major anxiety issues, I started receiving more of those per week than I would get per year after 2012. So it's yes. So these kids, it's, you know, the human mind, whatever. Yeah, what are we? What is thought, right? What is mental health? Well, what are we exposed to? You know, if we were born on a deserted island, what would we even think? Now, if we're spending hours and hours a day with just constant information pummeling, you know, our malleable brains, especially when we're young, like I said, that's going to shape our thoughts. And a lot of the stuff that's being, you know, driven into the minds of kids is not, you know, really healthy content. You know, it's eating disorder stuff, violence going on in society, fear, and so forth. So sure, that's going to have a big impact. Now, sure, there's other variables, but, you know, we didn't have, this was a different generation we were in right now, and there were no phones and screens and all that, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
We should also mention that a lot of it's not real. When you're thinking of the influencers, the filters and other tricks that are being used, you know, I imagine that creating, you know, this unrealistic standard for who we should be and how we should be can only be harmful.
Yeah. So let me give you an example. All right. So people, listeners can understand this. Back in like, I think it was 1957, some experimenter did an experiment at a movie theater in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And what he did is he flashed the word eat popcorn, drink Coca-Cola at 1/1000th of a second on the movie screen. So consciously, nobody would recognize this. Now, subconsciously, they did. And popcorn sales went up 57% and Coke sales went up close to 20%. That's the subliminal nature. Now, this is very subliminal as well. When you're sitting in front of a screen, that very, you know, impressionable subconscious, this information bypasses the conscious mind and secures itself right in the subconscious mind, the uncritical subconscious. In fact, about a year ago, there was a story of a whole bunch of teenage girls throughout the United States and Europe were developing motor tics that didn't have Tourette syndrome. So they gathered together and it came to the realization that what the cause was, and the cause was that these girls were on TikTok watching people with Tourette syndrome constantly, and their brain now started mimicking involuntarily those tics.
Wow.
Yeah.
What can parents do? I mean, what are the kinds of rules that you recommend? Is it total hours spent on screen time? Is that the main thing, or does it also depend on what the screen time is?
Yeah. So here's the deal. All right. So screen time technology is not by nature a bad thing, right? A one glass of wine with dinner by nature is not a bad thing. You know, 8 or 9 glasses of wine every night of the week with dinner is a bad thing, okay? And that's where we're at. It's the total amount of time. And it's designed, you know, to really hook these kids. It's very addictive. You know, all the apps, the gaming and all that stuff target that pleasure-seeking part of the brain. So what parents really need to do, some simple rules, is never allow that cell phone, that smartphone, to be in your kid's bedroom when they go to sleep at night. And almost every parent allows their kids to have that thing in their bedroom. And those kids are up till all hours of the night on that phone, which is now compromising their sleep. And that in and of itself is going to lead to anxiety, depression, and so forth. Car rides to school, you know, you'll note kids in the passenger seat, almost all of them are just staring down at the phone. Don't allow that. We have to interact with our kids, right? That's the most important thing. And we have to have restrictions. We have to, as best we can, have established rules, you know, of total screen time. And our kids are not going to like it, but it's what we need to do. Furthermore, you know, it's important to get our kids active, get them outside. If they're teenagers, get them, let them go get a part-time job, get involved in activities and sports, things that are going to get them outside of the house.
I wanted to ask you about cyberbullying as well, because that's such a big part of this, unfortunately. What is the best thing that parents can do to help on that front? Because the policies and procedures on dealing with it can vary, you know, from school district to school district, for instance. But what's the biggest thing that parents can do, especially if maybe they don't even know that their kid is being bullied?
So what I always advocated for kids was to teach them pro-confidence, right? And for parents to do that as well. really drive into your kids' minds what confidence is. Help your kids understand and accept themselves for themselves. You know, because a confident individual can't be bullied. You know, a bully can attempt to bully somebody, but if somebody's actually very confident, you can't be bullied.
Right, yeah, it's just going to bounce right off of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't mean you're going to, you know, get into a fist fight. It just means you're not going to interpret it. You're going to stand your ground. You're going to tell that person to back off. So I'm a big fan of that, right? Really, really teaching, you know, pro confidence. Now, if a kid's vulnerable, you know, doesn't have that level of confidence just because of their age and maybe their personality type, you know, it's important for parents just to watch out for warning signs. You know, your kid seems down or sad or, you know, sort of removed and withdrawn and so forth. You know, start probing, ask questions.
Well, I know another big thing is whether they have friends or not. And that may be another thing that parents don't automatically know. As you say, you're watching for those signs of isolation, those warning signs. When it comes to raising healthy teenagers or kids in general, is there one other primary thing that you tell parents aside from you need to rein in the screen time?
Yeah, well, what I try to tell parents is we need to practice what we preach as well. So what I want families to do, what I want parents to do is when we are home with our kids, sit down with our kids and have conversations, right? Teenagers are spending almost all of their time alone in their bedrooms. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. That's the most important thing we can do. Is be in the presence of our kids, have conversations, and that is probably the most important component for them in terms of developing a strong, healthy mental well-being.
One other thing I wanted to ask you, and that is, you know, I hear people talking about kids and their phones, especially. It's usually kind of a passing comment, though, almost an undercurrent of, well, this is just the way things are now. Is it too late to change that or to make it better? How do you stay positive about this?
Yeah, you know what? I hate when I hear that. You know, it's just the way it is now, because I'm not going to accept that personally. You know, that's why I'm writing books, going out there lecturing and so forth. No, because we look at this generation and, you know, we heard it from our own parents. Oh, well, my generation did this and your generation, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? This is different right now. You know, this is different. When we have kids, you know, a suicide rate that is, I forget what the number is, but it's, you know, astronomical compared to previous generations. You know, we have kids that are just lonely, depressed, anxious. You know, there's reasons behind that. So it's not too late. You know, if everybody, you know, finally kind of bands together collectively and starts taking action, you know, for right now, 1200 parents are suing Meta, Facebook. So that's an action right there, something like that, because they believe that, you know, those social media sites, you know, knowingly harmed kids with their algorithms and so forth. So no, I don't think it's too late. I think we need to, you know, right, like I said, slowly right the ship with, you know, the right information and tips and so forth. We can do that.
Family therapist Tom Kersting, author of the upcoming book, Raising Healthy Teenagers, Equipping Your Child to Navigate the Pitfalls and Dangers of Teen Life. Tom, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Liz Peek with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Sadly, 2022 was marked by a number of mass shootings, as we've seen in previous years. And this year, children were killed in Uvalde, Texas, at school. LGBTQ people were killed in Colorado Springs at a nightclub. And Black people were targeted at the top supermarket shooting in Buffalo, New York. This as U.S. intelligence officials and federal law enforcement repeatedly warned over the course of the year that the threat of domestic violent extremism is high, both from those who are anti-government and for those motivated by hatred toward people of specific religious, ethnic, or racial groups. Shortly after the Buffalo shooting, on May 20th, we spoke with Scott Shepard, a former KKK member, about what drove him into the group and what eventually drove him away from a life filled with hate. In recent weeks, we've seen multiple mass shootings, and at least two of them, law enforcement is investigating evidence that the suspects were motivated by racism. In Buffalo, New York, an 18-year-old is accused of opening fire inside a supermarket, killing 10 and wounding 3. Most of his victims were Black. The Erie County Sheriff said after the shooting,
"This was pure evil. It was straight up racially motivated hate crime. from somebody outside of our community.
Shortly after that shooting, Orange County, California law enforcement said a Chinese U.S. citizen opened fire at a church luncheon, killing a doctor and wounding five others. They say he was motivated by hatred for Taiwanese people. None of this is new. Sadly, the Charleston church shooting targeted black people. The Pittsburgh synagogue shooting targeted Jewish people. The El Paso Walmart shooting targeted Latinos. President Biden said from Buffalo this week,
"For the evil did come to Buffalo. It's come to all too many places. Manifest in gunmen who massacred innocent people in the name of hateful and perverse ideology rooted in fear and racism."
The latest hate crime statistics we have are from 2020. They went up over the prior year, though this year, the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University said hate crimes increased 46% in 2021 over the prior year, after analyzing 14 major metropolitan areas. Earlier this year, the head of the Department of Justice's National Security Division, Matthew Olson, announced a new domestic terrorism unit.
The threat posed by domestic terrorism is on the rise. The number of FBI investigations over the past 2 years since March 2020 has more than doubled.
He, along with Jill Sanborn, the head of the FBI's National Security Branch, testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee in January.
When evaluating the current domestic terrorism threat, we assess that racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists advocating for the superiority of the white race and anti-government or anti-authority violent extremists, specifically militia violent extremists, present the most lethal threat.
She said the largest threat comes from lone actors, often radicalized online.
I was born into a dysfunctional family with an alcoholic father who was a very violent alcoholic.
Scott Shepard is a former member of the KKK and now calls himself a reformed racist.
He would beat my mother and abuse the kids, not necessarily physically with the kids, but very, you know, verbally and just any way possible except, you know, physical. This left me with low self-esteem. I didn't like anyone. I didn't like myself. I had a lot of anger inside, and I just didn't feel that, you know, I had a home or a family anymore. So I started looking for a place to fit in, and I found that in the Ku Klux Klan, you know, where I started. I went to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I had a sister that lived there, and I was in her house and looking at her phone book. And right there in the phone book was Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Then I found out that the Imperial Wizard, the leader, lived on Eden Church Road in Denham Springs. So I went to his house and talked to him and told him what I was looking for, what I wanted to do. And he told me, he said, "Well, we have a rally in Tupelo, Mississippi, and you're welcome to come." And they encouraged me to come. So I did. And when I got there, the Klansmen put their arms around my shoulders and told me, you know, "We will help you and protect you." And I thought they were friends and family, but they really weren't. They were just you know, just tried to use me, you know, to benefit their agenda.
What did you guys talk about? I mean, was it all about race? Was it all about hating certain groups? What was that like?
Well, it was pretty much, you know, common knowledge, you know, that we hated minorities and Jewish people, anybody that wasn't white. Now, when I went in, I wasn't raised by racist parents. In fact, I was raised by a black lady, Rebecca Scott Hawkins, and she was a caretaker for my grandmother. And she actually, I'm named after her. Her name was Rebecca Scott Hawkins, and that's where my name Scott came from. But yes, you know, we talk about different things, you know, the national Klan groups and national office were doing and what they, you know, had planned on attempting to try. That was very negative actions.
When you hear now about, you know, these mass shootings that are, you know, like the El Paso shooting, the church shooting, and the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, and the one in Buffalo this past weekend, you know, we often hear about accompanying like manifestos and social media posts, you know, these rantings and ravings that sort of give us insight into the anger against specific identity groups. Do you read what these shooters write? And what is your assessment of what you read? How do you feel when you read that?
I do read some that, you know, if I'm, you know, fortunate enough to get a copy of it or find it, I do read it. And the people that are doing that are very distorted and don't have a reality on life. And it leaves me with a very, very deep-seated feeling in the pit of my stomach of guilt. And the reason I say guilt is because I recruited a lot of young people when I was in the white supremacist movement. And I used the same tactics for them that was used on myself. And I feel really guilty because of some of the people that I, you know, allowed to join and recruited. And I may have ruined their life by doing that.
Because you do follow the news now and you read some of the shooters, the mass shooters' manifestos or their social media posts and their motivations now, and you do have some insight into how they're feeling, what are your thoughts about why this is happening, why hatred and racism is persistent to the point where some people feel the need to act out violently? What could be done?
Well, we have a lot that are motivated by hatred, and I'm not sure. I have heard that the man in Buffalo, that his parents were racist, that may have played a part in him becoming filled with hatred and, you know, getting involved in the white supremacy ideology. But it just takes its toll on the people, and they just snap. You know, we call them lone wolves. People like the man in Buffalo, we call them lone wolves. And the bad thing about it is that they're indoctrinated right there in their own home, sitting in front of a computer.
Tell me a little bit before I let you go about, I think, the most obvious thing, right? How did you sort of deprogram? How did you get out of this mindset? Did you meet someone? Did you go to a dinner? Was it a moment or was it a process to sort of leave the ideology you had?
Well, I think for myself, of course, it was two things. There was a process, and then there was also an incident that happened that, you know, guided me out of the movement. Of course, Rebecca Scott Hawkins, you know, like I said, I love you dearly. There was always this little voice in the back of my mind asking, you know, saying, do you really believe the things that you're preaching and doing? Mm-hmm. But I ignored that because I was so eat up with hatred and self-hatred. But when I was in Nashville, Tennessee, I was at a restaurant and I was having dinner and also had some alcoholic drinks. I left that restaurant and got about a mile down the road and police pulled me over. When they pulled me over, I opened the car door and there was not just one police officer, there was an ocean of blue lights. There was a lot. And I was given a field sobriety test and I failed that and also had an illegal assault rifle inside my vehicle underneath the front seat of my car. I had that, and of course they sent me and took me and put me in jail. But when I went before the judge, I said, well, I'm going to go to an alcohol and drug treatment center and get the paperwork and come back to the judge and have the charges dropped. And that's exactly what I did, and it worked. But what I didn't realize was when I went into that treatment center, I was pulled over to the side by the director. And he told me, he said, you know, we've got people of all races, religion, sexual preference, you know, are you going to be able to, you know, handle that? And I said, sure, I just want to get my paperwork and go back to the judge and get charges dropped and go on with my racist life. But I didn't realize that when I walked in that door, I walked into that treatment center one person and came out another. And that's where I think another seed was planted for me to leave the white supremacist movement.
Scott Shepherd, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for your time. We appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am. I sure appreciate y'all having me on.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Liz Peek. What's on your mind?
New York stinks of weed. Everywhere you go, theater lobbies, parking lots, construction sites, delis, public parks, you can smell the bitter aroma of pot. Does anyone actually think this is good for our troubled city or for our country? It's absurd. And yet, mainly Democrats in financially wounded cities and states have rushed to legalize pot, grounding their campaigns on three questionable arguments. Number one, that the war on drugs and prohibition against smoking pot led to racial inequities, which could only be corrected through legalization. Number two, that selling weed and levying heavy taxes on those sales would be able to plug the budget gaps of profligate cities and states. And three, that marijuana was no more harmful than alcohol and therefore should be legal. Are these assumptions true? The widely disseminated claim that millions of Black Americans are unjustly imprisoned for simple pot possession is a myth. A 2015 study showed that in the federal prison system, which in 2020 housed 226,000 people, more than 99% of those sentenced for drug possession had originally been accused of trafficking or other crimes, but had been allowed to plead down to lesser charges. President Joe Biden made a big show before the midterms of issuing a pot pardon, saying no one should be in jail for possessing marijuana. He looked more than foolish when it turned out there literally was not one person locked up in federal prisons for that offense. The second argument for legal weed is that communities like Colorado, one of the first states in the union to legalize pot for recreational use, needed revenues, and that taxing a booming new industry would help close budget holes delivered in part by out-of-control public employee unions. For several years, the program worked. Colorado became the pot destination of choice, with sales of weed surpassing $2 billion in 2021 and tax collections totaling $423 million. But as more states and communities legalize pot, the profit and tax opportunity will drop. That's already happening in Colorado, and it will happen elsewhere. The final argument from cannabis proponents is that pot is no more harmful than alcohol. The jury is out. An activist group that focuses on protecting children claims teens 12 to 17 who use marijuana are twice as likely to advance to substance use disorder than teens who use alcohol or tobacco. They also say that young people are more likely to drive after consuming pot than alcohol, and that using marijuana products with high THC potency is associated with higher rates of schizophrenia, psychosis, and generalized anxiety. The legalization of pot is moving too fast, with desperate officials focused on revenues and not the welfare of their citizens. 21 states and Washington, D.C. now allow recreational use of pot. There's probably no turning this ship around, but those communities that have not yet taken the leap should look very hard at what awaits them on the other side. This is Liz Peek, Fox News contributor.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.